We know there are times where you're just too busy to sort through the mass of information that comes your way. So to make it easier for you to stay informed, subscribe to The Morning Agenda, WITF's news podcast, where the only agenda is you.
Funding for The Spark is provided by Capital Blue Cross, focused on creating a healthier future for our communities through innovations like its Capital Blue Cross Connect Health and Wellness Centers, which provide in-person services and inspire healthy living. Learn more at capitalbluecross.com. The Spark is also supported by UPMC. Choose UPMC for your family's health care needs close to home. Visit upmc.com/centralPA for a complete list of services and locations.
US 2.0 is the newest series produced and hosted by Hidden Brain and its host, Shankar Vedantam. And this series will explore how we, as Americans, form our political beliefs. And I'm honored to have Shankar on The Spark again with us. Hello, Shankar. How you doing?
Hi, Marquise. Thank you so much for having me back.
Yes, and thank you for coming back. And let's just jump right into things. So how do our personal experiences shape the political beliefs we hold?
So I think that is such a broad question because there are so many ways in which our identities, our personalities, our histories, our cultures shape how we come to our political beliefs, Marquise. But I think the short and important thing to keep in mind is that very often in our political sphere, we often find ourselves arguing with other people about the facts, you know, this number, that number, this statistic, that statistic. But really the point of the series, which, you know, could either be called, US 2.0 or US 2.0, is to really get under the hood of these political beliefs. Where do they come from? How do we know what's happening in the minds of people who disagree with us? How can we become more effective in communicating across differences?
And I was actually bouncing back and forth between is it us 2.0 or is it US 2.0?
I think it's designed to be both, really.
Oh, you are. Well, that is great. So can you share some insights from US 2.0 series on the assumptions we make about our political allies?
Yeah, so one of the key ideas, Marquise, is that very often when we think about our political disagreements with others, when we think about our political opponents, and, you know, I would encourage listeners for a moment, just imagine the people who are, you know, against you in the political sphere. Imagine what motivates them. Imagine how you're perceiving them. We often think that our opponents are motivated by anger and by hatred, because we, in fact, see people being very angry and sometimes being hateful, you know, on cable television and in the public sphere. One of the important insights that we explore in the very first episode of this series features the work of a psychologist named Kurt Gray. And one of his insights is that much of our reactions and overreactions in the political sphere come not from anger and hatred, but from feelings of fear and vulnerability. And his insight really is that as human beings, you know, we have a very long evolutionary history of being very keenly attuned to anything that could be threatening to us, anything that could do us harm. And that same mindset, if you will, has spilled over now into the political realm, where we feel it's not just a question of, you know, is my policy going to win the day or is my opponent's policy going to win the day? But we feel if our opponents were to get elected, if they were to have their way, they would basically take away everything from us that is of value. They would rob us of things that we are hold so dear to us that the only way that we can basically survive is to basically try and destroy them. And of course, they are thinking exactly the same thing toward us. But it's an important insight that in many ways, even though we may perceive hatred and anger in the public sphere, so much of that is coming from feelings of fear and vulnerability.
Oh, wow. That is interesting. So in this series, in what ways does history provide a valuable lesson for understanding and navigating our current political landscape?
So one of the episodes in the series features the presidency of Abraham Lincoln. And in fact, this is a conversation with the NPR journalist Steve Inskeep, who's just written a book about Abraham Lincoln called Differ, We Must. And it really looks at Lincoln's own example and how he navigated across these political differences, these challenges. Lincoln, of course, was grappling with what is arguably the single most important moral question in the history of the United States in the last 2.5 centuries, which was the question of slavery. And Lincoln was grappling with how he talked to people who disagreed with him on the question of slavery. How do you talk to people on your own side who agree with you? How do you talk to people on your own side who disagree with you? How do you talk to your opponents? And much of that episode, I think, is powerful because it shows that one of the things that Lincoln did, sometimes successfully, sometimes less successfully, was to try and always maintain a line of communication with people who disagreed with him. So you didn't have to, you know, our response very often is that when someone disagrees with us, we feel like taking our hat and leaving and basically saying we're no longer going to be part of the conversation because it's so unpleasant, it's so painful to be in conversations with people who disagree with us very strongly. One of the things that Abraham Lincoln did was he was able to stay in conversation with people who disagreed with him, to find common ground to the extent there was common ground to find, and to play the long game, to assume that, yes, you may disagree with me today, but in fact, there might be ways that we can work together 5 years from now, 10 years from now. Very often, I think we feel any kind of communication, compromise, keeping the lines of communication open with our opponents, in some ways is an act of betrayal towards people on our own side. Lincoln saw that it was not, that in fact, you become more effective when you stay in touch with your opponents, when you keep a line of communication open to them, and you ask how you can do business together.
I always wondered, you know, how social media would have played a part, played a role in some of our history's most pivotal moments, like the Lincoln presidency. So talking about social media, what role does social media play in shaping political beliefs, and how does it contribute to the polarization in our society today?
Yeah, you know, it's a fascinating thought experiment. What if we had, you know, Twitter and Facebook and TikTok during the time of Abraham Lincoln? And of course, we did. We didn't. You know, the media was far more limited in those days than it is today. But I think it's absolutely the case that in some ways, social media is partly responsible for the antagonism and the hyper-partisanship that we're seeing. Because, of course, on social media, you get attention, you get followers, you get noticed when you say things that are controversial, when you throw firebombs into the public arena. That's when, you know, your people are likely to wake up and take notice of what you're saying. And so in some ways, there are perverse incentives on many social media platforms to say the most incendiary and hateful things. One of the episodes in our series features the work of a political scientist named Yana Krupnikov. And her important insight is that even though when we look out at the political landscape, it feels like, you know, the country is deeply divided down the middle. You know, half the country is on one side, half the country is on the other side. The truth is, it's only a small fraction of people on either side who care so deeply about politics that they actually want to talk about it all the time. For many people, politics is actually secondary in their lives or even tertiary in their lives. It's a part of their lives, but it's not the most important thing in their lives. But the problem is when we look out at social media, all the voices we hear about politics are drawn from that minority of voices that wants to live, breathe, and talk politics all the time. These are the people who are often the most fervent partisans. They have the angriest things to say about, you know, their positions and their opponents' positions. And because we're consuming all of this, we draw the mistaken conclusion that everyone in the country is deeply divided and hopelessly, you know, partisan, when in fact that's not the case.
You are dropping some nuggets of knowledge here, and I love it. So how can the workplaces foster environments that encourage respectful political discussions among colleagues with different views?
Yeah, I mean, this is a tricky question because, of course, many workplaces are not about political debates, but these political debates now are spilling over into every facet of our lives. They're spilling over into the workplace. They're spilling over to conversations we're having across the dinner table or the Thanksgiving table. They're spilling over into public forums. So what happens in libraries and community centers? I think one of the really important insights that we explore in this series, Marquise, is the idea that listening is in some ways a far more effective way of changing our opponents' minds than talking. And I think this feels very counterintuitive to us because, of course, when we come by people who disagree with us, we feel that we need to disabuse them of their wrong views. And we believe the only way to do that is to shout them down, to speak louder than them, and to throw a whole bunch of facts at them. And we do this despite the fact that we have seen in our own lives, personal lives, professional lives, that it's largely ineffective to try and shout someone down. It's ineffective to try and persuade someone to change their minds by throwing facts at them. When was the last time someone persuaded you about something by screaming at you or throwing facts in your face? I mean, it never works. And so in some ways, the psychological insight here is that what happens in psychotherapeutic settings where a psychologist or a therapist or a social worker sits down and asks you questions, asks you how you come to your beliefs, why you believe what it is that you believe, why you care about the things that you care about, what is bothering you, what you're afraid of. These are the questions in some ways that allow people to articulate not just their political beliefs, but what's underneath their political beliefs. And as you get people to step one level deeper, two levels deeper, not only will they become more receptive to your points of view, they will start to question their own points of view in exactly the same way that happens in many psychotherapists' offices. I mean, as you talk for a little while, you start to say, you know, well, maybe I shouldn't have lost my temper, you know, when my boss told me that unpleasant thing, you know, last week. Maybe I was too quick to fly off the handle. But that comes about usually after you've talked for 15 minutes, after you've spent 10 minutes ranting about your boss and what a terrible person your boss is. You then start to say, okay, maybe I need to have a little bit more perspective. I can ask myself what I should have done differently in that situation. In our political disagreements, I think very often we fail to recognize this insight, and in some ways listening is a far more powerful, you know, approach to changing people's minds than arguing with them.
And I can tell you this, Shankar, I can listen to you talk this for another 15 minutes, but unfortunately, we have to go. This is Shankar Vedantam and with Hidden Brain and Us 2.0. I cannot wait to indulge in this and listen to the nuggets of knowledge that you will be bringing forward. Again, Shankar, thank you so much. It's an honor.
Thank you so much, Marquis. It's been a real pleasure.